In a couple of weeks' time, we are going to be going to Hannah's absolute favorite place in the world, which is a botanical gardens in Cape Town, which is called Kirstenbosch. And there's something wonderful about being able to go to a different part of the world and to see birds that you've never seen before, see flowers and plants and trees that you've never seen before as well. And it all seems to come together, the whole kind of African experience seems to come together when we go to this botanical gardens. And when you're there, you really do feel like you're in the Garden of Eden. There is so much beauty around you from the animals that you see and from the flora and also the wonderful landscape and mountains that you have surrounding you as well. But just like how it is, it seems like the Garden of Eden, it's also like the Garden of Eden in as much as there's a snake at Kirstenbosch, or more likely, a large number of snakes. And the first time that we went to Kirstenbosch a few years ago, I was just really worried about coming across a snake. And so as we went around the different areas, I really did enjoy the experience. But just in the back of my mind, I was a little bit worried. But we didn't see anything at all. And then the second time that we went last year, I'd completely forgotten about the snakes there, until I actually saw one. And it was quite close to the entrance. It was an area that you have to walk through in order to get through to the main area of the park. And there were a couple of women who were standing around looking up at a tree. And so people are kind of gathering around and, you know, wondering why they're looking up, what's so special up in that tree. And then we're told that there's a snake up there. And I can just about make out this snake that is kind of curled up on one of the large branches. And so we were there with Hannah's parents, and Hannah's mum, like she always does, starts chatting away to the people around about this snake. But on this occasion, we were incredibly rude and just kept on walking past these people and walked quite far away from this tree. And left Hannah's mum by herself, to herself, really. Because Hannah and I absolutely hate snakes to the point where, if we're going to talk about snakes, I only want a cartoon version up on the screen. Because if we have a real one, it's going to be very off-putting. But when we go on holiday in a couple of weeks' time to Cape Town, there will be various dangers around us that we need to just be a little bit aware of. We don't need to be too concerned by them, but we do need to be aware of them. And so you do find snakes in different areas where Hannah's parents run a Bible college. It's in quite a remote area, and I've been told that there are snakes around that place. So we probably won't be visiting it. But Hannah's parents' house there is actually kind of perched on a cliff face, and it goes down, and you've got wonderful views over the bay. But it means that you end up getting quite a lot of wildlife in their garden, which is kind of on this cliff. And so they've got a very long garden, and the first bit is great. But apparently, as you get towards the bottom of the garden, as you get to the bottom of the bay, there are quite a few snakes in the garden as well. A lot of these things I just hear about and I don't really want to discover for myself. At the same time, not only do you need to be cautious about snakes, but you also have to be cautious about baboons as well. And so they can be a real problem in that area and in other areas as well, to the extent where you have to have a special lock on your wheelie bin, because wheelie bins, if you can get into them, do attract baboons and they'll start to go through your rubbish. And the first time that I went to South Africa, we were going on this wonderful, beautiful coastal route, driving around in a convertible. And on the side of the road were this group of baboons, and they looked absolutely huge. And I was slightly concerned that because we were in a bit of traffic, we weren't going quite as quickly as we wanted to. We had the hood down, and I just had this sneaking suspicion that one might want to jump into the back of the car, but thankfully they didn't. And then last of all, I know there's lots of other dangers which I'm not aware of, and I don't want to be made aware of them, just to make that clear. But one of the other dangers that we need to be aware of are leopards in the area as well. And so where Hannah's parents are, at the top of the mountain, a year or two ago, there were some big kind of forest fires on the top of the mountain. And it meant that all of the animals that live happily up at the top of the mountain started to migrate down. And for Hannah's parents, their neighbour actually managed to take a photo of a leopard in their garden, who was just by their pool. I don't know whether he was drinking out of the pool or not. But that's another thing for us to be concerned with. We're very fortunate, aren't we, in this country, that we don't really need to be too concerned about snakes. Certainly don't need to be concerned about baboons or leopards. But although we don't need to be worried about some of the animals that we might come across, there are other dangers in our lives that we need to be aware of. They may not be quite so obvious as seeing a dangerous animal in front of you, but they are still dangers nonetheless. Although we may not be endangering our bodies and our physical health all that much in this country, we can endanger our souls. We can endanger our emotional well-being, our spiritual well-being, when we go about our lives. Although we may not have dangerous animals around us, we do have dangerous situations around us, dangerous environments, dangerous temptations that surround us wherever we go. And just how, if you were bitten by a certain type of snake and weren't treated, if you got captured by a baboon that ends up in the back of your car, or if you came across a leopard, you'd be worried about your life. So we need to be realistic in understanding that the situations and circumstances that we find ourselves in can lead to death. Maybe not a physical death, but certainly a spiritual death. And so this morning I want us to be looking at how sin can be all around us, and how sin isn't as harmless as the world makes out, but sin can actually poison us from the inside out. But I also want us to see how there is a wonderful antidote to the sin which corrupts all of us. And so we're going to have our Bible reading now, and we're going to read from the book of Numbers, chapter 21. So if you have a phone on you, if you have a Bible on you, then please do turn to that. We're going to be reading from the book of Numbers, chapter 21, verses 4 through to 9. And Marcia is kindly going to read for us.
It's called Numbers 21, 4 to 9, and it's the bronze snake. Then the people of Israel set out from Mount Hor, taking the road to the Red Sea, to go around the land of Edom. But the people grew impatient with the long journey, and they began to speak against God and Moses. "Why have you brought us out of Egypt to die here in the wilderness?" they complained. "There is nothing to eat here and nothing to drink, and we hate this horrible manna." So the Lord sent poisonous snakes amongst the people, and many were bitten and died. Then the people came to Moses and cried out, "We have sinned by speaking against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take away the snakes. So Moses prayed for the people. Then the Lord told him, make a replica of a poisonous snake and attach it to a pole. All who are bitten will live if they simply look at it. So Moses made the snake out of bronze and attached it to a pole. Then anyone who was bitten by a snake could look at the bronze snake and be healed.
Thank you. So in this point in the history of the Jewish people, the Hebrews find themselves in the desert. They have been wandering around for many years as a result of not being in the promised land that God had promised them, because they hadn't really found that trust in God which they needed in order to fulfill the promises and the good things that he had for them. They're coming towards the end of their 40 years in the desert and in the wilderness, and it is starting to take its toll on the morale of the people there. At this point in their journey, as they're wandering around, they know where the land of Canaan is, the land which has been promised to them. But at this point, they're actually walking in the opposite direction to Canaan, and they're wondering, why on earth is God making us do this? Why can't we just skip forward a bit? Why doesn't this 40 years just come to an end? Surely we've experienced enough. Surely we've learned our lesson by now. But we see that clearly they hadn't. There was also a promise as they were walking around in the wilderness that the current generation who hadn't been able to trust in God for the promised land would die out before the next generation were able to come and inhabit the land. And so in recent times of this story, we have Aaron and we have Miriam, two wonderful, inspirational leaders of the Jewish people, dying. And Moses, the great leader himself, knows that his time will soon be coming to an end. So you can imagine that the morale amongst the Jewish people was at an all-time low. They would have been complaining and they would have been concerned about really great things, really substantial things, but also on the smaller things as well that were starting to bother them. And in our passage this morning, we see that this is the third time that they had actually complained about the food that they had to eat whilst they were in the wilderness. And it just makes me think about fussy eaters and about how so much effort can be put into making a nutritious and often a tasty meal for children, and yet how fussy they can be about it. And I think just especially since we've been feeding Penelope real food, it's just kind of really humbled me and made me feel really guilty, actually, about when I was a child and about all the meals that I complained about to my mum, even though she had put a lot of effort into them. But in this case, it wasn't that God was trying to force feed the Jewish people broccoli, but rather it was a lack of options that they had to eat. When they'd been in captivity in Egypt, that even though they were in slavery, there had been different kinds of interesting foods available to them. But month after month, year after year in the wilderness, God had been providing for them manna and quail, and they were sick of eating the same thing every day. If you are a parent, and if you have been through the process, particularly for young children and older children, where you've been giving them food and they just cross their arms and they say, I don't want it. I'm sure amongst you, you have got various ways of dealing with that situation. Some of you might just say, Okay, don't have that. Have some fruit instead. I know that's quite a popular one. Or it might be you need to try something 3 times before you can say that you don't like it, and then you don't have to have it again. I've shared the story before of how Hannah's parents put some Stilton soup in front of Hannah's sister, and she refused to even touch it. But because she hadn't even touched it once, let alone 3 times, she was allowed to leave the table. But when she came back to breakfast the next morning, there was the Stilton soup ready for her. That seems severe, but it seems pretty lenient compared to what God did as a response to his children's complaints about the food that he had provided for them. So the Lord sent poisonous snakes among the people, and many were bitten and died. This was the third instance, the third occasion, that the Jewish people had complained about food. And it won't surprise you that this was also the last time that they complained about the food that they were given. As Brits, I feel like often we can be like Mr. Grumble. We can be people who grumble and we can complain. We can be negative about the situations that we find ourselves in. We can be negative about the world that we live in. We can be negative about the people that we spend our lives with. We can be negative about the weather. We can be negative about politics. There's so many things that we sometimes almost enjoy being negative about. But to grumble, especially in the context of what God has gifted to us, which we believe is every good thing, to do that is a sinful thing, and it's an offense to God. The Hebrews have this very obvious demonstration that God is upset with how they have been complaining. They realize the danger of their ingratitude towards God and towards the Jewish leaders. And so they ask Moses to pray that God will take the snakes away. They don't pray to God themselves, but they turn to Moses as their mediator to plead on their behalf that these snakes which have been surrounding them would disappear. Now God, in his sovereignty, in his authority over all nature, simply could have ushered the snakes away from their location. But as God is a creative God, as God wants for memories and for instances and for stories to be more memorable, to make more of an impact, to make often more of a more visual impact, he has a different way of going about bringing rescue, restoration, and healing for the Jewish people. And so God tells Moses to make a snake replica. In many of our Bibles, it will describe the snake as being made out of bronze. But actually, if you look at the ancient Hebrew, it doesn't really determine what kind of metal the snake was made out of. And because of archaeological evidence and because of the geography as well, it's more likely that the snake would have been made out of copper. And there has actually been in this region, dating from around this time, there's actually a replica of this snake, which had been fairly recently discovered, and that was made out of copper as well. And the instruction was given: anyone who has been bitten by the snake, who is still alive, can look at this copper snake and be healed. Anyone can look at this copper snake perched up, lifted up onto a pole, onto a wooden pole, and find healing. We've got little reason to worry about snakes. Even when I go to Kirstenbosch in a few weeks' time, I've got little reason to really worry about snakes. But we should be wary about the snakes of sin that surround us. There are consequences to our sin. There are consequences to letting the temptation of slithery sin come and bite us and affect us. There are obvious biological consequences to our sin. There's biological consequences to us being grumbling, to us being negative, for us taking our anger out on God for the lives that we lead. If you're a negative person, it will no doubt impact your mental health. Being negative and grumbling can have a negative impact on your immune system, on your blood pressure. It can contribute to heart disease and also to diabetes as well. But not only are there biological consequences to giving in to the sin of being negative and unappreciative and being grumbling, but there are also spiritual or Zoe consequences to being negative as well. If we give in to that kind of sin will poison our soul. That kind of sin will give us a different kind of heart disease. We have this truth from the Apostle Paul: for the wages of sin is death. That if we allow these snakes of sin to come and to attack us and to bite us, if it goes untreated, then the result will be death. Death in a physical sense, but also death in a spiritual sense as well. Death of our spirit, death of our soul, death of the opportunity to have a relationship with God and to have eternal life with Him. As God healed through a copper snake being hung on a pole, so God has also made a way of healing for each of us. Jesus brought up this story, which was shared in Numbers 21, with his own people. Jesus said this: as Moses lifted up the bronze snake or copper snake on a pole in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up. Through God's provision, not only did he have a way of salvation for the Jewish people back in the wilderness, but he has also creatively made a way of salvation for us as well. Not by lifting up a statue onto a wooden cross, but rather through lifting his own son to deal with the sin of the world. We read later on in our Bibles in 2 Kings that this copper snake, which had been created for this very specific purpose, ended up becoming an idol. People saw that God was working powerfully in the instance in Numbers 21. They saw that God was working powerfully through this copper snake. And so even when this season of the snakes had passed, they held on to this snake and they thought that it still contained the power of God. They started to burn incense to this copper snake, believing that it had wonderful properties to it in and by itself. And so it came to the point where when a man called Hezekiah came into power and he was trying to get rid of all the idolatry and all of the wrong thinking and all of the barriers that had been created between the Jewish people and their worship from God, he actually took that copper snake and he broke it so it no longer had any kind of hold on the people. Just as the copper snake had to be broken, so did the body of Jesus. His body had to be broken so that we could find healing in him. We have to appreciate that sin will continue to surround us. In the instance of Numbers 21, it's not as if God just got rid of the snakes. The snakes were still around. They were still biting. They were still venomous. And all that the Jewish people had to do was look to this copper snake. In the same way, we may pray that God would take away all of our temptation to sin, but we realize that whilst we are on this earth, there will be these temptations around us, coming up to us and we going up to them. But we trust that although sin will come and nip us and will bite us, whether it be the sin that we embrace ourselves or whether it be the sin that is done against us, all we need to do is look to the cross of Christ and we will find healing. There's a verse, isn't there, which says, O death, where is your sting? Through looking to the cross of Christ, the sting, the venom, the death that the sin can cause has been taken away through us looking to Jesus and what he has done. Jesus is the one who heals. Jesus is our antidote to the sins that we commit and that are committed against us. There was a missionary who lived many years ago who went out to Africa, and he had to go on many dangerous journeys as he went from village to village sharing the gospel. And on one occasion he was in a certain village and he was preparing his route to go to the next village along, and he was given a warning that there were many dangers on this narrow path that he had to take, but he knew he had to do it. And so he got up onto his horse and he started to make his way to a village. The path that he was on was incredibly narrow, just wide enough for his horse to be going along it, with steep banks and sides either side of him. And as he's going along, quite cautiously, quite gingerly, suddenly the horse stops. And he's wondering, what's going on? So he peers forward and he tries to look around the corner, and he sees a snake in the middle of the path. And he's wondering, what can I possibly do? I don't have any weapons on me, but he wasn't quite sure how he would use a weapon anyway in attacking a snake. He knew he couldn't just go back and wait for another day. He needed to get to this village. So what was he going to do? So he got off the horse, made sure the horse didn't get any closer to this snake, and he started to think about what he could possibly do. He looked a bit further forward, looking at the snake again, and he realized that there was a small flat stone on the snake's head. And he thought, maybe this snake is asleep. Maybe this is my opportunity to try and kill it. He finds a larger stone close to him, and he thinks, if I can use this stone, and if I'm accurate enough, I can smash this stone upon this other stone, which is on top of the snake's head, then maybe I'll be able to kill him. So that's exactly what he does. He goes, picks up a heavy stone, he comes across, and he is absolutely freaking out that this snake is just suddenly going to come out from under that stone and attack him. But he gets close, he gets as close as he needs to be, and he drops the stone upon to this other stone, which the snake's head is hiding under. Nothing happens. There's no flinching, there's no movement of the snake. What he realizes is that this snake was not resting its head underneath a stone, but rather someone had gone before him and had already crushed the snake's head with that stone. It meant that he was able to carry on his journey because of the one who went before him and dealt with the great danger that would have been in front of him. As Christians, we put a whole lot of trust and we put a whole lot of hope in something which is called the proto-evangelium, which means the first promise of the Messiah, the first promise of the gospel, which is given in Genesis chapter 3. This prophecy is given. He will crush your head and you will strike his heel. After the first people had disobeyed God, as they had listened to the snake, to the serpent, which had tempted them into sin, there were certain consequences for the ways in which they would live their lives. But not only was there these consequences, these negative consequences, but there was also this glimmer of hope that although that they had allowed sin into the world, God would make a way of putting things right. And that is what we see in the Gospels. We see that in the fulfillment of the gospel, that Jesus himself would be the one who would have his heel bruised, that he would go to the cross at Calvary, and nails would be hammered into his hands and into his feet, go in and bruise his heel, so that he could deal with the sin, with the venom, with the death of the enemy. But not only did our Saviour go to the cross and have his heels bruised, but at the same time, he did an incredible thing and he crushed the head of Satan himself. We call the hill that Jesus was crucified on Calvary, which is a Greek term. But in the Hebrew, it's called Golgotha. And the meaning of Golgotha is the place of the skull. Many thousands of years later, after this prophecy had been given to the first people, we have Jesus going to the cross. So yes, he would have his heels bruised in this battle between good and evil, between life and death. And he was victorious on that cross because he crushed that skull of death and of fear. And we gather together on Sundays, on other days, and it's wonderful to gather around the Lord's table to thank Jesus for going on that path before us, for clearing that path for us, to take away the dangers and the death that is in front of us, so that we might continue on the path to eternal life. Before Jesus went to the cross, he took part in a wonderful supper with his friends, where he prepared a table. He took bread, and he broke it, and he blessed it. And he said, "This is my body, which is broken for you."